The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, welcome to MotoPod, or MotoPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 256 for Friday, 17th of December, 2010. My name is Jules Cisek, and with me across from the across the Atlantic in the UK is Martin Darlington. Hey, Martin.
Hi, how you doing, Jules? Yeah.
Our second show together, dude.
Yeah, we've kind of, this is coming completely off the cuff, so it'll probably sound much more professional than usual. Won't have too long to think about it.
Yep. We just didn't want to leave you guys hanging, so here's a show for you. So why don't we roll through the couple of listener emails that we had?
Yeah, we had one from Steve Schmidt, and we always like to give Steve a mention. He's an American, lives in London. He's a master brewer, and therefore very likely to find a friend in Big John Hart, not to mention Bob, when he gets back, because he'll probably need lubricating when he arrives back from Afghanistan, and ourselves. And he sent in a very good suggestion, actually, for an off-season show about motorcycle sport photography, which I've certainly discovered from my feeble attempts with my little happy snap digi camera is a real art form, and there's a real knack to it, which certainly, without wanting to sound sycophantic at all, you've got, Jules, because I've seen some of the pictures you've put up from the American rounds and when you've been across to Brno, and they are fantastic. I mean, there are some in our circle, as in the bike racing community, there are some famous photographers who've done some really, really amazing pictures. And there have been so many of them now, I think we almost take them for granted. But every now and again, you just see a shot and you think, wow, that's just captured the complete essence of the sport that we love. So tips for people like me and some of the anecdotes about, the things that photographers have to do to get in the position to take those shots, I think would be a very good idea. And I think we should probably pencil that in for January or February.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. We actually had a show like this. Episode 125 was about motorsports photography. We had Andrew Wheeler, we had Scott Jones, and we just chatted about, into too much detail as photographers talking to photographers, and we got a lot of very negative feedback about it. But this is a long time ago. This is like, years and years ago.
Yeah.
I'd love to do it, of course. And Andrew Wheeler was actually emailing us saying, hey, maybe we should chat. And I've been planning to get myself and B, my wife B, and Andrew and Emily together over dinner. So I think we're going to do some kind of a interview where we sit down, we actually ask him to describe the food for us, and then we'll talk about photography. Because yeah. For those of you who don't follow Andrew's various adventures, not only is he an amazing photographer, he's also an amazing cook. At least he claims to be. And yeah. Following his culinary adventures is almost as exciting as following his MotoGP adventures. So, yeah, that should be fun. But, yeah, so thanks a lot for writing in. And the other thing was actually just somebody emailed me, Mike Lewis, who we met. I met him at the Ace a few months ago. When we were sitting over some beers, he had a really interesting idea for I'd like to talk about it later in the show. So he emailed me again, reminded me about it. But let's move on first to some news.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we've broken the news into the various bike disciplines and MotoGP. And I hadn't seen any of this coming. A new 125 team, the Super Martza. VIP team is being backed by Paris Hilton. Yes, I do mean the vacuous blonde socialite who appears to have no function on earth other than to make reality TV shows and spend lots of her family's money. But she is backing it. That's not going to get us any interviews, is it? She's back in a 1-2-5 team with Sergio Gadea and Maverick Vinales, who's the Spanish and European 125cc champion from this year. Sergio Gadea, obviously we know. And they're launching in 2011. The bikes are extraordinary. Pink, blue and white. And there's a picture of them on Motorcycle News website. I'll get the link in to the show notes. Do you remember when Matteus Pessini ran and won the race where
on the pink bike? Yeah,
yeah, on the pink bike when Simoncelli and was it Bautista? Wasn't it? Were punting each other off into the gravel.
Either them or it was probably Barbara and Simoncelli.
It was, wasn't it? Barbara and Simoncelli. Yeah, on that pink bike. I mean, it's that dramatic.
Wow, because that was for some club, right? That was like a local Italian club called Pink.
Was it a club or a charity or something? I can't remember if it was a charity. It was an awareness thing, though, wasn't it? It was a one-off. They're going to be running. They're going to be running these colours all season, I think. So,
because I mean, Rossi when he did the Azzurri bike, was it? It also was like blue and pink. Remember?
Vaguely.
There was this one-off livery that he ran in Assen, I believe, in 2008, maybe. And it was pretty hideous, I remember.
Yeah, but let's face it, he's going to get away with that.
Of course.
I mean,
of course.
Gadea and what's his name again? Vinales. I can see them getting a little bit of ribbing in the paddock.
I think that one. It's not just going to be over the colors, dude. It's going to be over the manager.
Boss.
The boss, I mean.
Mind you, you know, I mean, I suppose, you know, to a young testosterone pumped up bike rider, she's probably fairly decent to have as a team manager. You know, given the choice of going out for dinner with her, or I'm not going to pick anyone out because they're going to get really upset. But, you know, your standard team manager in the GP paddock, I suppose she might be quite an attractive proposition. The other bit of news, which I thought was really cool, was Motorland Aragon was awarded Grand Prix of the Year, Circuit of the Year, by ERTA. And their president, Hervé Poncharal, obviously the boss of Tech Trois, gave them the award. And it's the first ever debut season track to win the award.
It gets the Rookie Award.
So it gets the Rookie Award, but it also won the Grand Prix of the Year award, which,
that's so
considering
cool.
They had months, a few months to get ready, because remember, they were the reserve track.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They ended up standing in for Hungary, and they've retained their place for next year, and World Superbike are going in June of 2011 as well. So that is going to be really cool. Fantastic circuit. It is a Tilke design circuit, which isn't something that always enthuses me, but they did bring in the team that did Portimao.
I think he has a hit rate of about 1 in 4, because, I mean, the Turkey track, you know, in Istanbul, fantastic track, that's also Tilke. So I think,
yeah,
you know, he's hit and miss. I am so excited about that when I read that news, because it was a fascinating weekend, that weekend. Everything from the visuals, because it's such an incredibly picturesque place, that crazy wall. And then the race itself really produced some fantastic stuff. Maybe not up front, you know, because there was a runaway with Stoner, but it was also good to see Stoner back. But that fight that Nicky had and with Lorenzo, and then Spies with Dovizioso. I mean, it was fantastic. You know, it has a cool design because it has a straight going downhill, which means,
oh, of course, yes, that was the one, wasn't it, where we saw Ben and Dovi going down that mini back straight, and then when Ben came around onto the final straight, it's like, hang on, where's Dovi? And it's like,
exactly.
He's in the kitty litter.
Yeah.
And that was a great track. But as Toby Moody said, with that huge wall there, they're not going to be running that the other way around.
No, they're definitely not going to be running the other way around.
Very extraordinary place. And I love the fact that people are still producing tracks like that in these days where it almost started to feel like every new track was going to be a carbon copy of Valencia. The most track in the smallest real estate stadium where most people can see the whole of the track. Thank you very much. But goodness me. Although this year, Valencia was pretty good.
Well, it was a good race. That's true.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I don't think that the track necessarily, I don't think my problem with Valencia is that it produces poor racing in MotoGP. I think more that it's just that it's kind of flat and there's nothing undulating about it. I mean, it does have some elevation changes.
It does seem to make for processional racing, even though, I mean, yeah, it's got that long, long straight.
And it has it has a fantastic final corner. I think that's a great corner especially for motorcycle racing, where you're getting tighter and tighter and tighter as opposed to faster and faster. I think that really squeezes people, and it takes a lot of skill to go through it every single time, and it's a lot of laps. But I think that it's a flat track, so it's not like with Aragon going down that straight. You know, you're not only got these super fast motorcycles, but they're also accelerating because you're going downhill, and then you have to hit the brakes at the bottom, and that's when guys like Ben Spies, who are willing to just, I mean. You remember how he was passing Dovi. It just didn't seem possible that he was going to stay on track. It was so exciting. It was such an exciting race to watch. So I'm thrilled that these guys got the credit that they totally deserved it.
And I mean, I'd love to ride a track like Portimao, but although supposedly there's something like 5 blind crest corners. So I know I was talking to one of the track days I did last year. I was talking to one of the guys. And they just started going there, and they said we've had more people go off, not necessarily crash, but run off track there than probably anywhere else we've ever been. But I don't think you have to have elevation changes to make a track interesting or make for good racing, but it does seem to help. But if you think about the real classic circuits, the ones we love watching, Brno, I love the racing at Brno, huge elevation changes. What's the South African one? They don't go to any more World Superbikes. We're going Kyalami,
amazing track.
The mine shaft, they call it. I mean, that was just extraordinary. And Portimao, similarly. And yet, Silverstone, it was fantastic this year. And it's flat. I mean, it really is flat.
You know what, though? It's not that flat, though. It's got some interesting things going on that track. Oh, but yeah, I guess it's a little bit more like closer to Valencia than Aragon or Laguna Seca or one of these tracks that are really built into the landscape. And that may be why that track works so well. It was built kind of, they didn't build up that hill. They carved the hill up into a track.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was extraordinary. I mean, that was like bits of the Aragon track. It was like looking up the side of an alpine hill with the switchback roads going hairpin up, traversing up the slope. It was almost like that when they came at the top of the wall, and then at the bottom of the wall, you got people who've already passed that corner and coming back the other way. And you just thought, wow. I mean, somebody, I think it was Toby Moody, mentioned it's there's potential for a horrible accident there if someone were to lose it on the upper mini straight.
When they had the helicopter shots,
there's a lot of
to be a couple of places where there is runoff, but if you run off the runoff, it's a cliff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So parachutes issued on request. And the other thing is that Suzuki pressing on with development on a 1,000cc bike for 2012, despite the doubts about their participation in future participation in MotoGP, which is probably hopeful news. And I've not seen anything official published, but the rumors certainly were that Espoleta had done a deal with them and said, okay, you can drop to one rider for next year, provided you come back with two in 2012. And they've said, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's what happens.
Got it.
Because I think there was a bit of a dispute, wasn't it? Dorna was saying, no, you've signed up to provide two bikes. And Suzuki said, no, we've signed up to be involved. And I'm sure someone who drew that contract up must have said the minimum participation level is two bikes, one bike, whatever it might be.
But does two bikes mean two riders or two bikes for one rider?
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Yeah. Cause really the minimum participation for two riders would be four bikes.
Right.
Unless they chose to go with one. And
I mean, they could. No one's stopping them. I don't think that their rules require you to have two bikes, right?
If you had a flag to flag, wet to dry, or dry to wet, you'd have a bit of a disadvantage when they have to change your wheels.
This is one of those moments where like better knowledge of the rules would you know, or just speaking like Spalders would help.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this, by the way.
Did you see the email from Nick Codling?
Yes.
He said Spalders hasn't got the deepest voice in MotoGP broadcasting. He said it's Martin in his pre Marlboro wake up in the morning voice. And he signed it Nick Husky Codling.
Brilliant.
So I thought I'd try it again, and certainly it's true that Suzuki are a manufacturer of motorcycles. Something like that.
I have to work on my Julian Ryder. All right, so and then we'll just do a Eurosport tribute show one time. Jim can beat Toby.
Absolutely. Can he get to those levels? I mean, it's almost hydrogen balloon levels of excitement, though.
It'll be hard.
I absolutely love the way they work together, though, because you have Toby sounds like his head's about to explode, and Julian's like the voice of sanity, which is bizarre because he's actually a bit of a mad professor, you know, genius, but and his knowledge is insight, you know, he'll come straight in, but his tone is always the calmer one, and it's in a way. Although it's a very different relationship, it reminds me a bit of Jack Burnicle and James Whittam on the World Superbike and British Superbike commentary, where Jack gets completely manic and carried away, and then often will come out with something that's complete bunkum, and James will sit there and go, "Well, actually, Jack, you're talking nonsense because he's not in this race. He looks like the man I was talking to," you know, and you just, it's brilliant. And I do love the banter that they all enjoy.
Yeah, and the thing is, they're you know, they've been doing it for long enough where they don't have to communicate. They just perfectly balance the commentary between everybody who's in the room. It's just really great. I got to see them working at Brno during the 125 race, and it was just brilliant.
Of course, yeah,
it was
you brilliant. Got in the box, didn't you?
Yeah, I was hanging out, just watching, and. And I actually have some video, but I don't know if I want to show it. But it's just amazing just seeing just how I was just sitting there going, "Wow!" I mean, they're super pros. They're more than pros. They're just freaking amazing, and I love listening to them. And their commentary is always the best. I mean, I love Gavin Emmett and Nick Harris on MotoGP.com. But the second time I watched the race, I always watch Eurosport. You know?
Yeah, definitely, definitely, and. It's just such a shame we don't have Randy Mamola anymore as the pit guy, because they used to, it was almost like they were baiting him with humor, which he acknowledged, accepted, and just let it roll off him. And I really used to like that, you know, be like, "Right, Mamola, what's happening down there? Come on, come on." But he always came up with the goods. And
not only that, but he would say things like, "Oh, check it out. He's doing the Laguna 2008 race."
Yeah, I know exactly.
He called everything. He called everything that was going to happen. He was like, "This watch Stoner in turn three.
Going into the deeper sand."
Yeah.
That's deep sand out there. And as soon as he said it, he hit the deep sand and down he went. Yeah, exactly.
And before that, he was saying, you know, turn three, watch Stoner in turn three. This is where he's faster than Rossi. And that's on that last lap when Stoner fell. That's when Stoner took Rossi. That's when Rossi got, I think, so red and passed Stoner on the outside, and I think that's when. But I think that's really what where Casey got a little upset. Wasn't the runoff in the course.
And someone went by Casey at one of the backmarkers. I can't remember if it was Ant West. I can't remember who it was now, but someone went by, and I can't remember which way round it was. Either Toby or Julian screamed, "Is that Vermeulen? Is that Vermeulen
yes,
through?"
Yes, yes,
everyone's
yes.
Like, "No, I've been watching."
Yeah.
No, one of them is going to have a heart attack if they carry on. It's like, never mind Casey and Valentino going hammer and tongs, the commentary team. But that was one of your sample Pepsi. What was it you called the Pepsi test?
That was Bobby used to run the Pepsi challenge. That's right.
Ah, that was fantastic.
Yes, 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 fantastic. Yes.
And those little bits of that. And I was going to say, I think that was the first time I heard Charlie Cox use that phrase, "That shot the fox."
Right,
which I've actually done a bit of research on.
Oh, good.
Apparently, even though he's an oaf, obviously from the colonies, he's an Australian. here comes some more hate mail. Jamie McVeigh is going to come up from Portsmouth and kick my head in for that one. But it's a posh English fox hunting thing. When you hunt the fox, the idea is, you know, the dogs catch the fox, and that's the sport. And the huntsmen follow it. But if someone shoots it, that's the end of the sport. It's unsporting, and it's ruined the contest, and it will be...
I got it.
We all trucked home, very embarrassed, because that's not a sporting way to dispatch a fox. Apparently, having it torn apart by a pack of dogs is. The English aristocracy have a bizarre sense of right and wrong. But that apparently is what shot the fox means. That's it, contest over, end of all the fun, let's all go home.
Got it. Oh, that's very useful. Yeah. I'll use that all the time.
It just annoys me, yeah. I've actually changed it now. I'm saying that's shot the cocks, because I know I wouldn't advocate that anyone should shoot Charlie Cox. Just put him out to retirement. And the BBC have they've awarded the film, or the company that are going to do the production for them for Major GP next year, is a company called Century Films, I think. But it's likely Steve Parish and Charlie Cox are likely to remain. Steve Parish, no problem with it at all. I like Steve Parish. He's got a good dry sense of humour. He knows what he's talking about. As with most British motorcycle fans, could we have someone who knows something about motorcycling, or is at least appears to be interested in it as the main commentator? But interesting rumours, Jenny Gow's place is in doubt because Susie Perry might be interested in coming back.
Ooh.
I think she might have wanted a break to explore other avenues, and those avenues might have turned out to be cul-de-sacs. No through roads, so she might be interested in coming back. I think she'd be welcomed back with open arms.
For a while, I thought that she may have been behind Twitch GP, but I no longer think that.
Mm. Well, Gavin Emmett was a lot of people's prime suspect.
Yes, yes.
But I think he's managed to deflect that one, which probably means it is him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he's a playful soul, so it's the sort of thing you'd expect him to do. I suspect he might have had some involvement. Anyway,
yes.
Well, this is a bit of a crossover bit of news, really. World Superbike, World Supersport news is actually that Johnny Ray, along with his Suzuka 8-hour teammate Kusuki Akayoshi, have been to Sepang, where they were testing an RCV 212V. And Johnny, over 3 days, I think, completed 140 laps. He's still suffering from pain in his wrist from the late season World Superbike crash he had. I'm trying to think where. It's escaping me. But he busted himself up quite badly just after I'd put him in my fantasy road race.
along with was it Monza? Yeah. No, I don't think it was Monza.
I'm trying to think.
But I remember he
called. Monza was the comedy crash at the beginning of the season. Do you remember where he lost it on, I think it was the parabolic or one of the fast corners? The bike tumbled, jumped the barriers and disappeared. And he stood up and ran back to where he thought it was and then stopped and was looking around in a very sort of Keystone Cop slapstick comedy way.
Oh, yes, because the bike was gone. That's right. The bike gone. It was brilliant.
It's like, right. And then he sort of walked off disconsolately.
Yes, I love that.
But he's out there. He's been testing the HRC, widely tipped. Supposedly HRC, he is one of their golden children.
So let me ask you this. When these riders, like, you know, when Simoncelli got a ride on their Superbike, for example, and on their Aprilia, and, you know, this kind of a thing, these, you know, they're kind of spun like it's a gift for the way that, you know, Johnny just really rode the Honda and Superbikes this year. But obviously, there's a future here that they're looking. You know, is he going to go to Gresini? In a year, who knows? You know, I doubt there's going to be a 4-man HRC team, and I don't think anyone's leaving that team. Well, actually, no, Delvey could be leaving. next year, who knows?
Yeah, I know. I know exactly what you're saying.
Next year, I'm saying 2012, of course, not 2011.
Yeah. I mean, there's too many riders and not enough bikes. Having said that, when we get to 2012, we may see a significantly expanded grid with the claiming rule teams.
Right.
And I'm sure that Honda will do what they always do, which is support to a greater or lesser degree. You know, hopefully more satellite teams who choose to run Hondas. Hard to say. I think they wanted to get him on it and also just to have a look at his adaptability. He's clearly not going to be running an 800cc MotoGP bike anytime because he's staying in World Superbike for the coming season. But certainly about mid-season this year, a lot of stories are breaking in the British motorcycle press that, you know, he was a favoured son and HRC were paying a lot of attention to him and thinking, yeah, this guy's got it. You weren't sure about him at first, were you?
I thought he was a little nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And you have to be.
Well,
no, I know what you mean, but would you say that, I mean...
Would I say that now still?
Any more than Simoncelli?
No, but then I said the same thing about Simoncelli.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
And I still do.
And well, yeah, but I think he's been a fascinating case of watching him come to terms with the bike, come to terms with the other riders and the standard.
You're talking about Simoncelli.
He finds himself, yeah. And through this season, really start to mature. And, I mean, the Valencia race, he gave it to Jorge good and hard, but
he did, but Martin, he does that every year. Every year he starts off nuts and then calms down towards the end. It's like he can't get it. It's like he's just can't wait to get on the bike and start racing and, you know, messes himself up, misses the first couple of races, crashes into people, you know, gets fined. And then all of a sudden he calms down. I mean, people talk to him and then he wins a championship or whatever. I mean, yeah. he's an interesting character. I think he's extremely hot-blooded. Extremely, much more so than a lot of other riders.
I think he's very aware of who it is who's around him, and I didn't enjoy watching the Sepang race where he put some
rough
bordering
moves.
On it dangerously illegal moves on Ayama. He was not going to let Ayama through, and of course, the person who benefited from it all, I think, it was Bautista, wasn't it, who managed to get past the pair of them.
He did, and you know, it would have been worse, except for the fact that Ayama actually ended up finishing ahead of Simoncelli, so he once again beat him in that same situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Hiroshi. I think he's one of those classic Japanese guys as comes across as quite humble, meek, humorous off the track, but you stick him on the bike and he'll mix it. You know, it's Norihaga.
Right. Right.
You know, another case in point of, I mean, there was a very, the talk that Jim had with Ben Spees, which was just fantastic. I've listened to it three or four times now. And he was saying it was interesting about, you know, he says you can't really be friends with a teammate or a rival, except, you know, in fairly rare circumstances. And yet his closest rival in the World Superbike year was Norihaga, and they got on like a house on fire. And apparently he was Uncle Ben to Norrie's kids, you know. but I just thought that was a really nice snapshot of, you know, of Ben's quite inscrutable at times, I think. You know, he's not withdrawn, but he's keeps his thoughts to himself. And
he's the first to admit that, too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it just... And like when Jim was saying to me, you know, any advice for young riders up and coming? And it's like, yeah, you've got to work. You've got to be dedicated. You've got to decide if this is what I want to do.
It's not a party.
No. And there's, I mean, we're in this country, we're going through this with the young footballers, some of whom are getting paid, you know, 15, 20 million pounds a year.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous for a kid barely out of his teens. I mean, this is the extraordinary, the very, very few, the very, very top. But, you know, I mean, I think the average Premiership footballer wage is well over £1 million a year. And they just don't have the hunger. They're, because of, you know, human rights legislation, all this sort of thing, they're not allowed to make them clean the senior pros' boots or clean the dressing rooms anymore. So there's not that sense of progression. But I think if you want to get to the top, I mean, a lot of people rib David Beckham for the celebrity life that he leads. But when you read about when he was at a club, he'd stay for 2 or 3 hours after every training session and just take free kick after free kick after free kick.
Right.
You know, that's how you get good.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, I'm going back to the Ben interview. I just thought really insightful. I mean, the thing for me was when I went to Valencia at the end of the 09 season and watched him on the wild card ride. And I think I mentioned it, that was my sound check, wasn't it? What do you call it? Screen test, if
right,
you like.
Right, right.
With the voice email sort of race report thing I did. And it was that thing of reading afterwards when he said, I just didn't want to mess up anyone else's race because these guys are racing for championship points. I was just there for the experience. And realizing that's why he kept looking over his shoulder. And that level of awareness. And when he hunted down Dovi and we'd done our maths and we'd worked out if he beats Dovi, Colin gets fifth in the world in the championship for the season. It was just fantastic. And at that stage, I thought, oh, yeah, he's really, really bright. I mean, as in not just an intelligent guy to talk to, but under pressure, under that amount of pressure, with all that going on, he can separate his psychomotor skills, as in the technicality of riding the bike. I mean, in the flying world, I think lots of people probably do, we call it capacity. You know, he has capacity, division of attention, that you can take home in a shopping trolley, because he was absolutely awesome. And I think that, I've got to be honest, I don't think he'll be as quick as Jorge over the whole season, certainly not next season, but I expect him to win a race.
Yes, me too, totally. I mean, they're very different. They're very different backgrounds. I think Ben is much more. I think we saw a lot of the what we can expect from Ben on the Fiat bike at races like Aragon, and you know where it was this aggressiveness that you know made up the places that his bike couldn't do for him. Yeah. Once he's on this faster bike, I think he's going to be able to apply that as well. But he said it himself, you know, Lorenzo is perfectly aligned for the type of bike for the 800s, basically. Like, you know, the riding style just fits perfectly that bike, that electronics, the consistency that Lorenzo can muster lap after lap after lap. So, yeah,
which is
very different. I think very different kinds of riders, those two.
Yeah. I think where Jorge's got more of the complete package than Danny is the fact that he can move off his perfect line and still make as much time up, or you know, and when he's able to overtake people. I think that's been Danny's problem is when, and initially possibly his cases as well, was that when he couldn't take his line because someone was in the way and had to get past them, that's when they seemed to struggle.
Yes.
And I mean, just I've put a note in later on, thinking that talking about predictions for next year, Sharon and I are on a bet that neither of us like eggs. Egg fried rice, fine, I can deal with that, but neither of us eat eggs in any real shape or form, other than in baking. And so the deal next year is whoever gets more points. If Rossi gets more points than Lorenzo, I have to eat a sloppy fried egg and take Mia to school wearing, and I'm only allowed to wear slippers and a dressing gown. And if Lorenzo gets more points than Rossi, Sharon eats a fried egg and takes Mia to school wearing nothing but slippers and a dressing gown. Don't ask me why.
Wow.
We're just coming up.
Wow. You did, okay. You all heard it here. Okay, that is good.
I'm quietly confident, yeah. And obviously, photographic evidence will be provided on the MotoPod Facebook page.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Well, thanks for that. The both of you.
And of course, I'm also up for a crate of beer from Big John
Yes.
Well, two crates of beer, actually, because it's double or quits at the end of the season, personally delivered to North Wales, which he'll probably enjoy, particularly if he comes over in the off-season, because we can take him skiing down our street.
So, what were we talking about? Oh, yeah, superbikes. Max Biaggi.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a dad. He's now had a boy. He already had a girl, of course. He's now had a boy, and he's called him Leon. And I thought, that's interesting, seeing as Leon Haslam was his closest rival. Is it just a name he likes anyway? Is it a, you know, mark of respect? Is it, I was first, my son was second, I was bike riding, Leon was second in the bike, I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, it may be completely coincidental. For all I know, Max's father-in-law or his grandfather was called Leon. Not particularly Italian name, I don't think, but I don't know. Interesting. It'd be interesting to see if in an interview someone says, why did you choose Leon? Because you don't get the impression he's hugely popular with the rest of the paddock.
Oh, Biaggi?
Yeah.
No. Sorry.
Oh, is he the only World Superbike champion who's also been a GP champion at some level?
No. No.
I'm trying to think who else has.
Wait.
Because he was a 250 champion.
Because Kaczynski was 250, but he wasn't a Superbikes champion.
He didn't win Superbikes, did he?
No.
Now, he is a strange cookie.
Fogarty. Did Fogarty do GPs? I don't think Fogarty won any GPs.
No, he certainly didn't win a championship.
No. Yeah, I think you may be right. That's kind of odd, huh?
And
if anybody can think of somebody, write in, because that's actually a great question.
And I didn't even realize it. I should have said, I've got a great question here.
Well, you do.
And of course, the next item I've put in World Superbike and World Supersport is absolute nonsense because it's a MotoGP item of news that this was how thrown together this show's been. Was Randy Depugnet has decided to delay surgery on his leg, his injured leg, which he got just to, basically the cause of it was me putting him in my fantasy road race team. Everyone got stuffed up by that one. When Mika Kallio ran over his leg. But he's the pin that they fitted into his leg is slightly too long, which has been causing him some knee pain. So he either had a choice of having it removed completely and the leg undergoing physiotherapy to recover, not sufficient time before the start of the season, or he could have had the pin removed and a slightly shorter one put in, but that's still a 2 month recovery time and he wouldn't have enough time before the season testing started. So he's decided he's going to live with the knee pain till the end of the 2011 season.
Ah, man, you know, I hate hearing that stuff, by the way, because I remember when McCoy had some pins that started coming out and he had to have his boot changed so that he could accommodate this pin that was coming out. I mean, it just makes me feel just... The amazing pain that these guys, you know, have to deal with.
The one that I always find I come back to in if someone's coming to the sport and they're saying, you know, God, so these guys ride with broken bones and all that. It's the Mick Doohan comment when he'd smashed his leg up so badly, and one of the docs in the clinic immobile was. Putting a cannula in and saying, yeah, well, don't worry, we'll get some painkillers into you. And suppose you turn around and said, nah, you're right, doc, I'm not a painkiller kind of guy. And you think, hang on, you got a leg that's almost dead and you're not a painkiller. I mean, someone said to me once, you know, so basically the champion bike riders aren't the best riders. They're just the ones with the highest pain threshold. And I thought, no, they're the best riders who also have the highest pain threshold. Because if you don't, I was going to say, if you don't like being hurt, none of them like being hurt. But if you can't compartmentalize that pain, put it away and ignore it, you could be as skillful as Rossi, but you're never going to get there because you'll have given the sport up. When it hurts too much, you're going to go, you know what? I'm not doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like me was like me and rugby. Playing rugby at school. It's on a freezing cold February morning, and some fat kid would stand on your toe, stand on your fingers in the first 5 minutes. And after that, I was like, don't give me the ball. I'm not interested in having the ball. I don't want it. As soon as you give me a ball, all these fat kids want to sit on my head. Don't know. Yeah, so rugby wasn't for me. But yeah, so RDP, well, no one's ever going to doubt his courage.
No. And he certainly proved, I think he, you know, I said this before, I think he out-Rossied Rossi in terms of the comeback. It's just that he's not Rossi, so he doesn't get the accolades from everybody. But Christ, he was out for 5 weeks, 6 weeks, seven weeks total. With a lot worse of a break.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Although, I mean, as was commented on the time by several of the pundits, was, you know, the easiest bone to recover from for a rider is a long bone. Pin the top, pin the bottom.
That's true, actually. That's true.
But it was a compound spiral fracture, I think, which is not good. You know, but it's the shoulder. And interesting, this came out with Rossi, really. The injury that caused the most problems on aggregate through the whole season was the shoulder.
Right, right, right.
Rather than the leg.
No, I'm just saying that Randy really deserved some serious accolades for a very heroic comeback. And I mean, Rossi broke his own leg. Randy got ran over. So it's, I mean, yeah, he fell. They both fell. They both fell down.
Yeah, but Randy got taken down. I'm sure he got taken down by someone else. You're right.
Yeah, that's right.
Didn't he? Was it
the Saxon Ring?
It was Saxon Ring, wasn't it? Yeah. And it was so tragic because he'd been doing so well up to then. And that fantastic punch-up he had with Casey and Marco Melandri and someone else was involved, I can't remember, when afterwards Casey Stoner said, yeah, Marco was, you know, absolutely inch perfect. Had a good dust up with him. Randy overtook some people without meaning to. Every time he went into a corner, he was on a different bit of the tarmac that he'd been the time before. Yeah, it did make me laugh, but I don't think Casey was saying it with a smile.
No.
And I thought, well, what do you want? You know, crazy cyber's Frenchman, both tires on fire. I love watching him race. He may not suit Casey's idea of what good racing is, but I don't think he's dangerous to other riders other than himself. And he's gone an awful lot better at that.
Definitely.
I think, didn't Lucio Ceccanello say to him when he was asked, how come you've stopped him crashing so much? And he said, oh, I just basically told him if he crashed again, I was going to take it out of his wages.
Nice.
Oh, and you know, I believe he's now engaged to his playgirl.
No.
Yeah.
Seriously?
I believe so. He's either engaged or he's certainly, I mean, I'm not sure if she's going to leave if Playboy are continuing the sponsorship of LCR. I'm not sure if she's going to leave Playboy, the Playboy organization, because obviously RDP's got a Pramac. But I'm trying to think where I heard it. I can't remember. But he is romantically involved with the rather gorgeous young lady who we saw him with most of the season holding his brolly. If you gave Sharon the option, she might volunteer to be Randy's brolly girl, at least for a race or two when I wasn't looking. yeah, she's rather fond of him. She's got her RDP mug. It's, you know, the mugs you can get with the photos.
You know, that's so sexist. I mean, just because a guy shows off his pecs a couple of times, that's sexist, chauvinistic chicks, you know.
But she's like that over Valentino as well.
Yeah. Well, whatever.
She says she's beautiful eyes, apparently.
Yeah.
But she's very disparaging about Jorge. And I just keep saying to her, honey, it's not what he looks like. It's how he rides. That's what's important to most bike sport fans. She's like, yeah, but she said, I like the way Randy rides. It's just when he does crash. And I thought, you know what, love, you should talk to Grace from the F1 pod. I can't remember what they're called. Do apologize to Grace and Tom, isn't it? Bob's friends who do the Formula One podcast, because I believe Grace is a bit of a RDP fan.
Oh, quite.
Not necessarily for his Psychomoto skills either. Am I waffling?
a bit.
How you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, I'll tell you what, I've just noticed, and I've never seen this before on Skype, because normally we just have the show notes up, but when people speak, their little picture, like, pulsates.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of erotic, Mark.
Jim, have you been inhaling helium? I just heard you say, oh, yeah, in like a really high-pitched voice.
Like a girl.
That being said, we have been inhaling Boddington's for about the last 2 hours.
Two hours? You started at 9 a.m.
Like a French girl. You sound like a French girl, though.
Oh, well, we have a French girl. Say hello, Bureau.
Hello.
Hello.
Comment ça va?
Ça va bien, et toi?
Oh, comme si, comme ça. Où est la plage? That's the end of my French.
Oh, good.
I can say, how are you, and where's the beach? That's it.
Beret.
Oh, yeah, and my other famous one is, mon pantalon, c'est froid.
Ah, your trousers are cold.
Your trousers are cold? How's that going to pick up chicks in the...
You'd be surprised, actually. On my pilot's course piss-up, which we went to Paris for, no, it didn't work there either, actually.
Sounds like an excuse for having a small willy.
This entire call has been like this. I've been dealing with Martin just going off like on these weird tangents about pants, and it's just out of control.
Welcome to my world, Jules. let me give you a little background. I flew down here a couple of days ago, hanging out with Mark and Bureau for the last two days.
At our house, if you can believe it.
At our house. Their house, our house. But, wow.
I was going to say, that's a Freudian slip.
Well, you know, it's funny. I said to Mark this morning, I'm like, you seem like a little brother that I never met before.
After all these years, you finally met.
That's right.
Yeah, we knew we were going to get along after talking for so long, and clearly we did. Although it was one of those moments where you meet somebody that you've talked to a million times, you've never met them face to face. You're like, holy shit, is this going to work?
It's like a blind date, you know?
Yeah.
I never even saw a picture of him until he rolled up to my driveway and says, can I crash on your couch for a week? We've been having fun, though.
Yeah. The weather is miserable down here. It's not classic LA weather. It kind of looks a lot like it probably looks up in the Bay Area or almost in the UK without any snow, Martin. But we're getting on. We went out last night and actually 2 nights ago, we went out and we hung out with a bunch of other motorcyclists down at a pub called Twain Hart.
The White Hart.
Or White Hart. And had a great time down there. And yesterday we were just kind of goofing around. We went down to a Mexican restaurant, had margaritas, classic LA type thing, and then went off and went to another pub. It's been kind of nonstop.
Absolutely shit-faced.
Yeah. They have a pool table here. I mean, you know, it's like, okay, it's the perfect little kid's paradise. And I'm having a great time. Mark and Bureau have been great hosts, as well as the
homeowner. And Jim actually made breakfast this morning.
I made breakfast for everybody.
And we didn't die.
And was it like cereal and milk or something?
No. Like nice thick cut bacon, seasoned eggs, muffins. Well, Bureau made the muffins, but the whole nine yards.
Nice.
Yeah, it was a good deal.
As you find out later on when you listen back, Jim, I don't like eggs.
Are you coming back, Jim?
I'll be back tomorrow afternoon.
But you are coming back, because I was going to say, you know, you might just stay there.
Move in?
Yeah. It sounds pretty cool.
You're welcome.
I don't know. If I cook and actually pay rent, I might get along here pretty well.
Well, at least somebody would pay rent around here for once.
That's cool.
See, Mark, how convinced are you this is the real Jim Race?
I have no idea. He could be an imposter. I don't even know who this guy is. Actually.
God, the fact if there was a double of me, that'd be really messed up.
I don't really know who he is, to be honest. He just showed up and knocked on the door, and I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, if you need a place to stay, I suppose you can. I mean, no, he's a cool guy, man. I'm really stoked. I've got a new friend, and it's been brilliant having him over.
It's been fun. We had a great time.
So, Mark, we're coming to your house next, brother.
Yeah, we're going to be over there soon.
I mean, Mark, I guess you're going to be doing the TT again.
Yeah, we're going to try to do one at least again. One more, yep.
And then we are just sort of over the water. So will you come to the mainland at all, or you go straight to the island?
No, we always go through London, but we can get over there anytime. We do it all the time. It would be great.
Yeah. I mean, we're near Chester, so we're not far from
Liverpool. Yeah.
From the North Wales ports that go out to the Isle of Man.
Yeah, piece of cake.
Oh, that'd be really good. That'd be good. Particularly if Jim's coming over as well.
You coming to the TT to meet up with, what is this guy sitting next to me? Jim. Jim Race?
Jim. That would be...
What color hair does he have, by the way?
It's white, like mine would be if I didn't dye it.
Yeah, that's...
Just making sure.
Like mine would be if I had any left.
I mean, it sounds like Jim Race. I can kind of...
White pubic hair is all over the toilet now, too.
Hey!
I'm kidding. I didn't see one.
No, it's definitely the real Jim Race down here. And no, I'm not some cute French girl, although I've been having the last 2 days of staring at probably the cutest girlfriend on the planet. Hi, Vero.
Yeah, I'm getting a bit concerned about the fixation you got.
I'm sorry.
I mean, I don't know if I'm even going to bother editing this. We're recording.
Good.
Are you going to admit to the fact that you got on the back of my motorcycle through the Malibu Canyon roads?
No, but the cops have all the video records of it, so.
No.
Okay, I guess not that.
We're going to get hate mail now.
Have you guys been out riding before or after the drinking?
Both. No, we haven't. We have not. No, I would never drink and ride a motorcycle.
The two-wheeled conveyance has not taken place this entire last couple of days. So
you don't ride, Jim, do you? I mean, when was the last time you rode?
The last time I rode was 2 years
on the track, right? Racing.
Yeah, I only do track riding myself.
Yeah.
Although if Mark sourced like a 400 or something, I would probably chase him
around.
You
and your little pussy bikes. I don't know what's up with that.
Yeah. So listen, so we had this guy, Mike Lewis. I met him in a bar in San Francisco. Oh, wait, that doesn't sound too good. But...
I was gonna say.
Anyway, he's a moto podcast fan, and he had a really cool idea to ask a bunch of people like us about who they think should have won a MotoGP or 500cc crown that did not. And since we got all you guys on there, why don't you just go ahead and give me some thoughts?
Biaggi.
That was what I said also.
Yeah, and the obvious one, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. 98. It would have been so cool. You know, rookie season, and he could have done it, too.
Well, okay, so you're including MotoGP, so 990s, 800s?
Yeah, 500s, 990s, 800s, everything. Yep.
Then I would have to say Pedrosa. He hasn't lived up to expectations, but you still think he can do it.
I like it.
I don't. I know. Oof, I don't think he's been consistent enough, and I don't think I think he suits certain tracks and he doesn't others.
You know, so, Mark and I were talking this morning about certain racers and how some of them seem kind of to be made of glass when they crash a bit. And they, and Pedrosa might be that way. You know, he might be somebody that just, you know, any old tip over and he falls to pieces. And that he's,
yeah, and I'll qualify that. You cannot doubt his courage, but he does seem to hurt easy.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you have an idea about who from that era might, or any era in the Premier rank?
I mean, Marco Melandri, potentially.
Mm.
To be honest, anyone who's come second to Valentino, if Valentino had never tried it, to quote the the title of his autobiography, what if he'd never tried it? Well, we'd have a whole bunch of different champions, I suspect.
Well, you know, hang on a second. Marco Melandri finished something like 150 points behind him. And if there was no Rossi that year, it would have been a very different set of results.
Mark just said Gibernau, and I agree with that as well.
Gibernau's good. Gibernau's good. The guy that you guys have not mentioned and that Mike was surprised I did not mention is Mimola.
The perennial number two.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's amazing that Schwantz only won one.
Yeah, true.
And that was the year that Wayne Rainey had the crash, wasn't it?
In the lead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Misano.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was about to say Alex Crivier, but of course he did. Again, that,
yeah, but Doohan
was in the year. That was then year when Doohan had the crash. Yeah. So
right. It's like Neil Hodgson. Yeah. Same story. It's weird how some of these guys have had their limelight on the backs of someone else giving it to them.
You think Neil Hodgson in Superbikes was kind of an anomaly? Like he didn't deserve it as much?
I take that back. I my understanding is that Fogarty had control over the championship and Hodgson was able to win it because he fell. Is that not true?
I mean,
I think that's
it's fair, definitely fair. But Hodgson was doing a pretty good run.
Oh, of course. No, I take nothing away from the guy. He's fucking awesome.
Yep.
So I was on Pit Pass Radio and they wouldn't let me swear.
What did they do when you did?
I said shit once on accident and they all like fell apart.
Did they?
Not really. Like, oh my God. Like, oh shit, man. Oh, I just did it again.
The funny thing is they turned, it was clear that they listened to Motopod. I'm pretty sure they
That's so true.
And so they kind of had an idea about how Mark was. And listening to them kind of tiptoe around the way Mark is, I laughed the whole time I was wondering. In fact, it was funny. I got home on Wednesday evening or Tuesday evening, and Mark calls me.
Wait, this, hang on a second. This is starting to make sense now. So you basically went down there because he was two-timing you.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. No, I had to make sure my bitch was staying in place.
Right, got it. Okay.
Love you, baby.
Anyway, you're saying...
They were very adamant about me not swearing, though, before the show started. They're like, look, you can't swear. This is on the radio.
So you basically pulled like a Jim Morrison.
It was the last word I said on the show. I finally said shit. I just couldn't help it.
Anyway, thanks very much for having me on the show. And by the way, shit.
Like South Park, you know, 128,
129. That's great. Well,
the Sex Pistols famously were the first people to say the F word on British television on the, I think it was Ed Grundy show. But no one noticed that Steve Jones had said it about 5 minutes before the one that everyone noticed. But it came out so fluently. He said, yeah, you know, we just mess around with the fucking girls and stuff like that. But it came out like that so fluently, no one noticed. And then 5 minutes later, it was the one that was replayed on all the television news channels, you know, with it bleeped. I say all of them. I think we had three channels then, with it bleeped out. And someone said, hang on, they'd already said it once.
Right.
But he was winding them up to do it. I mean, goodness me, haven't we come a long way?
Well, you know, it fascinates me, Martin, and Jules is, and this is boring, I know, but you can say murder, you can say adultery, you can say rape, but you can't say shit or fuck. Like, those are...
Yeah.
It's taking a dump like everybody does, or you make love.
Yeah, there's no way. Well, you put you to the choir. I'm so annoyed with that kind of crap.
So ridiculous.
Hey, I got a question for both of you guys, because both of you guys have listened to me talk to Mark on and on and on and on, and I know that you probably each both have a question you want to ask Mark. So you've got an opportunity now.
I'm so famous.
Go.
I've got one racked up and ready to go here.
Can you grab me a beer?
Yeah.
Can you get me a beer? Well, is that the question?
Yeah.
See,
the question.
Now he calls Jim baby. Hey, can you grab me one too?
Guess what? I have to spank you when you get up.
Oh shit! Oh, we didn't spank him. Mm. Sorry, guys, we're digressing.
Yeah. What I was going to say was. In the road racing world, when you were talking to Jim about McCown, you were saying about the was it Ian McDonald or Cameron Donald, sorry, who wasn't on it? No, John McGuinness, wasn't it?
Last year,
John McGuinness. Last year he was just I'm not there. When you go to the TT or you go to Macau or the Ulster or the Northwest 200 or something like that. Do you look at these guys with their reputations and measure yourself against them, or do you now have the level of experience where you can just know, yeah, that was a good lap. I don't think I could have gone any quicker, or I could have gone a bit quicker here, there. Hmm. I mean, because John McGuinness was so consistent for so many years. Is he a reliable benchmark for you to be able to think, right, okay, well, I'm 4 seconds behind him or I'm 2 seconds ahead of him, whatever?
The honest answer just from me, one rider, and that is I don't give a shit what anyone else is doing. When you're up against the roads, you go as fast as you possibly can safely, and where it puts you is where it puts you. You know, sometimes the bike will have a factor. Sometimes you'll have a little bit more motivation for some odd reason, like a little French girl's watching or something like that. But no, seriously, you can't push this. I mean, you can't. The second you think I'm going to try harder, you're going to kill yourself. I mean, let's be honest. Every time you try to go fast, Scott Russell's my hero, and he had told me once to my face, he says, you know, anytime you try to go fast, you go slower. You just got to relax and ride the bike and listen to what the bike's doing, but just connect the dots, you know, and you get that momentum when you're calm, when you're cool and collected, you're going to roll on that gas a little bit better. You're going to get into the corner a little deeper. And that's like I said, it's just one opinion, but no, I cannot try any harder. You know, I can only go as fast as I can.
Can you tell when you're in the zone, to use the cliche? Is there something you recognize that tells you this is now good? Or there's a little caution caption that go, hang on, I'm being a bit complacent.
That's a very cool question because I really had to think about it. Yes, but it's after the fact. You already accomplished special. Right. And then you remember, you recognize that as you came out of that corner, you're like, Jesus, I'm on it, man. This is cool. Like, I really did well. And I've been doing it well all day or all week. And you just happen to realize that it's almost like a realization, but it's not something you can go try to do, at least for me.
No, it's interesting you say that because in my ridiculously limited experience of doing track days, when I did
a little world of racing.
Yeah, exactly. In my very shitty little world of racing, doing a track day at the Ron Haslam School when it was still at Donington, the first one I did, and the instructor said, right, we're going to slow down by 5% because you're just trying too hard. And it was on that next session that I did the best time I did.
Yep.
Which was in the dry, 16 seconds slower than Chiannari in the wet. which kind of puts it. And he couldn't have been that aerodynamic because he was sideways around the entire circuit. I'm sure you'll remember that. That was two seasons ago. That was amazing. But, and afterwards I got back and Sharon was like, how did it go? And I said, I beat 2 minutes. I did 1:56. She went, wow, that's really good. I said, no, it's not. In a World Superbike bike race, Troy Bayliss would have lapped me five times.
But that thing
about being in the zone, afterwards I couldn't tell. I said it felt comfortable. And he said, well, that was a 1:56. That's the quickest we did. And I was like, So I couldn't tell when I was actually being quicker than I had been when I thought I was trying to go faster.
If you race enough and often enough, you can tell, you know, because you're often at the same racetracks that you're used to or whatever. So, yeah.
But I think the most illuminating thing you said there is you can tell, but afterwards.
You always try hard and the chips fall.
Yeah.
Is my experience. And that sometimes the bike lets you down. Sometimes the bike's brilliant. You know, like you ride it to a certain feel. Colin Edwards once famously said, I don't know to the public or just to me, but he can only go as fast as the front will slide. You know, you can only slide both wheels so much and then you're done. You know, you only have that. That's all you can do. And I love that statement because it shows how much better he is than me, for one. And that those guys are going to the limit and physically with physics, mathematics, and that's as fast as they can go. I think that's a brilliant thing. And it's a beautiful thing for the sport, you know, like to know that that's the sport that we love.
Yeah.
All right, Jules, you've had minutes to think about it.
Yeah. Now I have a question for Mark, because one thing that we never talked about with him is what the hell gets you to started in bikes. Why did you even want to do it?
Do what?
Race. Or even ride bikes. Like
Scott Russell or racing Doug Pullen at Daytona 1993-ish or something that was it for me. Like to see Scott Russell put on his helmet and look at the camera and go, what the fuck do you want from me? Like, you know, he was so larger than life and so talented, and the guy would push it and push it and push it. But I don't know, dude, I think you're born with it. I think you actually are born with a certain, you gotta do it. Like there's no way in hell I couldn't be riding motorcycles. Like if they exist, you know, it from the time you're a little tiny child that you are inherently going to end up on a motorcycle as soon as you possibly can, even if you're hiding it from your parents down the street. Like that's what I had to do. Cause my mom was there's no way you're going to get a motorcycle. So I hit him at my friend's house. I mean, like right away, like at the very beginning. Anyway, we all have that story and they're boring to hear if somebody else told that story. But my story is that you have no choice. You have absolutely no choice in the matter to ride motorcycles if they exist, if you're me.
Did you never notice, by the way, that little kids, respond to motorcycles with smiles? Like,
absolutely, they wave at you. And
isn't it crazy? It's crazy. It's like there's something very low level, I think, going on.
I think that there needs to be, and I hate to let the cat out of the bag, but I think that there should be a feature film on motorcycles in this day and age. A sport bike movie, a summer blockbuster hit like Titanic or Avatar, where you really just appreciate how amazing these little contraptions are, how beautiful they photograph, and also how risky they are. You got the freedom with the fucking hair in the wind bullshit. But every little child waves at you. Every person knows that whether you're a wheelie dork or a professional road racer on the Isle of Man TT, there's a certain romance about that. It's very romantic. It's very beautiful. It's very cool. And, you know, it can go mainstream. And I cannot believe they haven't done it yet. It's right there for the taking. Nobody's done it yet.
It is
somebody.
Sorry. Go on.
No, just somebody whispered to me that James Cameron was looking into making a road racing film. True story.
And the gentleman sitting next to me here has been having dinners with a certain guy named Mark Neal as well.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, Mark Neal's working on his Charged thing and also the Nexus.
Yeah, and Charged is supposed to be coming out very soon, guys. So big news there.
Is that
and do we know when can we actually
say that?
We can't
have to edit that out.
Well, he's got a deadline mid-January to present it at a film festival, and then probably tweak it a little bit more before it's out, actually released.
Got it.
Is that Charged or Fastest?
Charged.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. Excellent.
It should be fun to watch. I mean, I've heard a lot about it. Like, he's told me lots about it over a couple of pints, and they're such interesting characters. I know it sounds like, how could it possibly be interesting? Electric bike, they're slow and they're dumb.
Considering the guy sitting next to me is the lead character.
Right. It's actually, there's some, have you seen that Cedric guy? Have you seen that guy interviewed yet?
No.
He's the dude that makes the motors for the Agni.
Cedric. This guy with kind of funny teeth.
That guy's a character.
No, totally. He talks like Mike Tyson with his high-pitched voice, but he's got these crooked teeth, and he's like 7 foot tall. He's just brilliant. I mean, it's a character to listen to.
But on the film front, I totally get what you mean, Mark, because it is that kind of a biker going through a village. It's like the gunfighter riding into a farming community, or the knight arriving in a bevy of damsels in distress or something.
The Russians are
but
coming.
There is that slightly risque, outlawish feel to it. And I think a lot of blokes particularly will look at it with that could be me. Mm. Well, it's freedom, isn't it? It represents freedom, I think.
Yeah, and the chicks dig the guys too, though. You can't. There's a lot of female motorcyclists out there these days, aren't there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the chicks dig the boys in the leather suits with the sweaty hair. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
what is it about? I don't know where you found it there, but certainly in Britain, we the motorcycling community, in all its different aspects, feel very much put upon and barely tolerated. Rode to Assen a couple of years ago, and families are sat out in their front gardens waving to all the bikes going by. And I hear this is exactly the same in France, in Italy. I don't know why they embrace it and we don't, but certainly in Britain, it's all you get is complaints about the noise and the speed.
Well, America's even a step lower than Britain, I think.
Oh yeah,
which is
all good. You know what? F them if they can't take a joke.
Yeah,
you know they'll catch up. I mean, if they don't catch up, who needs them? You know what I mean? Like we've got ourselves. We know how beautiful, how amazing this is. But I do think that mainstream could happen if somebody just did it. It would change the world. It would literally change the world to what was this niche turns into actually the coolest thing on the planet.
Well, it's interesting that what you were saying that you were born, you felt, you know, you were born to do it. You had to do it. You had no choice. Because one of our recurring themes when Jim and Jules and I have spoken and your names come up is we've got to try and get you and James Whitten together. Because he said exactly the same, pretty much exactly the same thing. As soon as I got on a bike, I had to ride it. Once I was riding, I had to ride it as fast as I could. Then there'd be some other kid who thought he was faster than I, so I had to be faster than he was. Mm-hmm. But then there'd be another kid with a faster bike. So I either had to get by him by having a faster bike or just by being dirty or aggressive or whatever, but being a better rider.
Smarter.
A similar sort of well, it's not like it's something I chose to do. It just happened.
Mm. Yeah, and Jamie's, he's the real deal. I'm a poser, you know.
Well, then Mark said to me this morning, we were having a smoke on the patio, and he said, so did Jamie ever say, you know, dude, Mark Miller's a poser or something?
He's full of shit. No, Jamie Whittam's cool. And I appreciate what he said there. That's you can't help it. I mean, what's weird about the competition, the actual competitive nature, is once you do something well, like ride a motorcycle, even if you're by yourself, and then you're like, you put up next to next to another animal, you know, another like you, another Homo sapien, another whatever. You go, well, I want, you know, F you, I'm better at this because it's complicated. You know, it's complex. It's actually difficult to do. And if you run into this once in a while, somebody that does it also well, you want to be superior to that guy. It's inherent. It's human nature. I think it's actually, you know, not just our species, but all species are survival of the fittest, all that blah, 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 blah. But yeah, no, it's I like what he said there about having to go faster than the next guy.
You guys would totally laugh because Mark is massively competitive. We've played pool. We played stupid video games on his computer. Everything. Every time I beat him, he gets pissed off and he gets all sulky.
Stupid, stupid video games. What are you talking about?
It's funny.
Anyway.
So you recovered now?
No, actually, I'm not. Because
you're still
mad. No, I'm still pissed. Yeah.
Well, Mark, listen, do us a favor and just. Make sure you send him back. Okay.
Yeah. Well, trust me, we have about 6 hours of noise that I have recorded.
I am not the adult supervision around there. Vero is. So Jim Race is going to stay out of jail. We actually had to bail him out last night. No, no, it's his. It would be his doing, not mine. He's the bad influence.
I am
with that disclaimer.
Oh, I know. That's what I'm saying, man. You gotta make sure that he gets back because he might not. He might just move in.
I'll do my best.
Okay. Good luck. Good luck with that.
All right, guys. Cheers. Thanks a bunch.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Nice to talk to you both, by the way.
Cheers, Vera.
Nice to speak with you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great. Great.
Bye-bye. Thank
bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. All right. Well, that was crazy.
Yeah, that was really cool. This crazy thrown together show has actually worked.
I like it. I'm going to wrap up the show by saying that we are going to be off next week for holidays, and we'll be back the week after, and then we might take another week off at the very beginning of January, depending on, you know, everybody's travel plans and stuff like that. But
if anyone wants to know what we're doing, what I think suggest we do is we'll wrap it up on the Facebook page,
exactly.
And we'll put it on Twitter and let people know. So this week there'll be a show, next week there won't, week after there will, week after that, we'll see.
Sounds good.
And a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to all our listeners. And for those who don't celebrate them, happy.
Happy whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Just be happy.
Excellent.
Excellent. Brilliant. Cheers, Jules. And I will speak to you, hopefully, in a couple of weeks' time.
Cool. Ciao.
Have a great time yourself. Good night.
Bye.